Kennedy, that was Anderson, but Conley, that's Blanche.
Yes, sir.
Four, and Mr. Sevens. Who's going to argue for Sevens?
I will, Your Honor. Jim Conley.
Very good, sir. You have 15 minutes. How much time would you like to reserve for the panel, sir?
I would ask for 2 minutes, Your Honor.
2 minutes, sir. Very good. You may begin with that.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning, and may it please the Court. I and my co-counsel, Aaron Blanche, are here on behalf of the appellant in this case, Charles Severance, who is appealing his convictions and sentences on two capital murder charges, one first-degree murder charge, a malicious wounding charge, and a number of related gun charges. For purposes of just shorthand, I think I'll be referring to each case as the Dunning case, the Kirby case, and the Lodato case with all charges grouped together for purposes of consistency. The convictions relate to three murders that took place here in the city of Alexandria over an 11-year period between 2003 and 2014. All of the charges were joined over the objection of the defense, and trial occurred, and were tried in one trial, which took, I believe, just over 3 weeks. There's as Mr. Anderson just demonstrated, a very large record in this case. And two of the assignments of error, as luck would have it, deal very heavily with the nature and sufficiency of the evidence. So I will do my best to be as succinct and accurate when describing the evidence and referring to the record.
But I think, there were a whole lot of issues and sub-issues in this case, and I think I can say with some confidence the Court is aware of the facts leading up to everything. And so if you could focus on the legal arguments as opposed to the sufficiency of the evidence arguments, it would probably help us. I think we understand the sufficiency of the evidence arguments. The other arguments are more legal and technical.
I understand, Your Honor, and I will do just that. I guess I would just say, to the extent I make a reference to the facts, it seems inconsistent with the record. I think the party's briefs do an excellent job of kind of laying it out, and I would certainly defer to what's in the party's briefs regarding any sort of accuracy. The first assignment of error that's presented to the Court is the question of whether or not the Dunning case, the motion to sever the Dunning case from the Kirby and Lodato cases, was incorrectly overruled. And it is, of course, our position that that case should have been severed. The standard there is the trial court has what's been described as limited discretion to join cases, provided that the joinder doesn't violate Rule 3A6B or Rule 3A10, they work in tandem. Making that analysis, the court needs to determine, one, are the joined offenses part of the same act or transaction, or based on connected acts or transactions? I think in this case the parties all concede that the Dunning case is not part of an act or transaction. The relevant question is it part of a common scheme or plan that was being carried out by the defendant, Mr. Severance, in this case? The trial court correctly ruled that it wasn't part of an act or transaction, but ruled that it was, in fact, part of a common scheme or plan.
And would you agree, counsel, that answer, and I appreciate you setting out the proper legal standard, is a mixed question of law and fact?
I think it is. The Commonwealth, in its brief, seems to argue it's more of a traditional abuse of discretion standard. But as I read the cases, when it references limited discretion, and that discretion is violated when the rule is not correctly followed, I believe that's a mixed question of facts and law for the court to decide, so that whatever facts the court found to support the ruling are entitled to discretion absent an abuse of discretion, but the court itself can apply de novo the rule to those facts.
Both through its argument and through its presentation of evidence suggests that the common scheme or plan in this case was the vendetta that your client allegedly had against lawyers and judges and the Alexandria system.
That is the theory that the Commonwealth advanced to support joinder. However, a an examination of the evidence, I would submit, doesn't support that theory. Dunning murder doesn't contain any of the sort of distinctive or idiosyncratic facts that the courts typically look for to allow the find, to allow joinder under the, under a finding of a common scheme. There's really standing alone very little evidence tying Mr. Severance to the Dunning murder.
Was the wife of the local sheriff.
Correct? There's no question that she was the wife of the local sheriff. And the Commonwealth presented its theory that Mr. Severance was very upset about the custody ruling that the city of Alexandria had made in his son's case, and that the sheriff had, of course, executed various orders on Mr. Severance pertaining to that custody. But there's nothing in the record that directly establishes that Mr. Severance ever targeted explicitly Sheriff Dunning or his wife. There's just nothing that specific. It's all very general.
Fact finder conclude that because of this alleged vendetta that Mr. Severance had against law enforcement and the sheriffs and the judges and the like, conclude that it was happenstance that Ms. Dunning was at the house when Mr. Severance allegedly came to the house, and that she was a victim of happenstance. In other words, coming to see the sheriff to confront him, Ms. Dunning's there, and she ends up being a victim of the case.
If there were sufficient evidence to place Mr. Severance at the Dunning home, then that would be a reasonable inference. But there isn't. There's no evidence that places Mr. Severance at or near the Dunning home at the time of the murder. Unlike the Kirby case where, I believe it's a Mr. Bertillo, plumber says he's 80% certain that he saw Mr. Dunning near a road crew.
Mr.
Severance. Or in the Legato case, there were people who placed him near the vicinity. There's none of that in the Dunning case. The only proximity evidence is the fact that he used to live near there.
What is the significance, if any, of the similarity with bullets and firearms?
The Commonwealth makes much of that, and I would submit a close examination of that evidence shows that it's really very weak. All we know is that it's a .22 caliber long rifle Remington made a hollow point bullet, which during the time frame in question, the 11-year time frame, I believe, Remington made at least 1.2 billion rounds of that and sold it nationwide. We know that the gun that fired the bullet in each of the crime scenes had a barrel on it that produced 8 glands and grooves with a right twist, I believe is the terminology that the experts used. But that is not very much of an identifier at all, because numerous guns, at least 10 models, are capable of producing that. It's not the type of microscopic evidence that forensic experts rely on to say this bullet was fired from this gun. That's wholly lacking in this case. There's nothing tying those bullets to the type of .22 that Ms. Rogra owned, or the type of .22 that Mr. Severance was found in possession of in 2004, other than the fact that, yes, that type of weapon also produces 8 lands and grooves, but many, many weapons. So it doesn't, while it may be suspicious, it may raise some sort of question about the probability of whether or not Mr. Severance was in possession of the murder weapons in these cases, it's not sufficient to establish it beyond a reasonable doubt. That's our position.
And I'm going to ask you to switch gears, if you would, for a minute here with that, hopefully throwing you off. But your third sign of error about the punishment in this case, the penalty in this case?
For the base double jeopardy argument regarding 31-8 and how that's to be interpreted, yes.
Yes, I'm going to ask you a question about that, if I may, recognizing that we'll come back to your first issue. The two murders for which your client was sentenced, two capital cases, those were not part of the same active transaction, unlike in the Andrews case. Isn't that correct?
No. I think it's the Andrews case. Mm-hmm. Yes. This is, I believe, a question of first impression for the court as to the applicability of 31A and how a conviction should be set, how conviction should be set as under that statute. But I think Andrews provides the closest analogous analysis that we have from the court. And in Andrews, the court said, if you're going to charge somebody with capital murder for killing two people during the same transaction, then you get one conviction for the transaction. You don't get the fact that there may have been multiple victims doesn't lead to multiple convictions.
Right. In this case, it was not the same transaction.
It was not. It's the 3-year period. So, but applying Andrews' emphasis on the one transaction aspect of 31.7 to 31.8, logically, it should follow that what governs 31.8 is not the number of victims killed in the 3-year period, but the number of 3-year periods. I mean, here we have one 3-year period in which two people were killed, and so that should be, that's the capital offense. It's one capital offense because two murders occurred in a 3-year period. He should now, as Andrews points out, the Commonwealth can see multiple capital charges, but once the case reaches its final determination, if they are duplicative or otherwise violate the multiple punishment rule of double jeopardy, then they've got to laugh. They've got to pick one, and one falls by the wayside. And that's our position here, is that they get one life sentence in this case, not two. That's what we would ask the court to do. In this case, Mr. Severance is, of course, serving three life sentences, so it would result in two life sentences plus multiple years. So realistic that the impact on him individually would be substantial. But still, I think for purposes of future cases and court precedents, it's an important issue to address. Going back, then, if I may, to the joinder issue, and without just sort of laundry listing the things that are, without trying to laundry list too much, I guess I have to a little bit, that the sort of reasons why these aren't distinctive crimes and why the Dunning case is actually, when you look at it, quite different. I mean, first of all, you've got the 10-year gap. And while that may not conclusively eliminate the possibility of a common scheme, certainly I think it gives rise to a reasonable inference that if 10 years happen between two events, they're not part of a common scheme ordinarily. That would be the more common inference there. We also don't have in the Dunning case direct evidence.
You're not suggesting that time alone would necessarily preclude.
Not necessarily precluded.
Because suppose theoretically, I see your time, I'm not going to take up too much, a little bit more of that again. But suppose that an individual had an idea that he was going to kill several people, and he killed these individuals over a course of 10 or 12 or 15 years. You're not suggesting that could not fall under the common scheme of plan theory under some circumstances.
Under the correct circumstances, it could, Your Honor. But I think the 10-year gap is large enough that it has to call into question more than it answers whether or not there's a common scheme here.
But you're suggesting that time should be a factor.
Should be a factor that the court looks at. Some other factors that the court can look at that distinguish the Dunning case from the other cases, there's no evidence, there's no direct evidence that she was attacked through the front door. This whole idea of the knock parable, knock and enter and kill, there's no evidence that happened here. In fact, the evidence seems equally as strong that her assailant may have entered through the garage door, because may have followed her in through the garage door, which would differentiate it. She was killed by a contact wound to the back of the head, which is very different from how the other victims were shot. They were shot in the front from a distance, which would be more consistent.
Now, if you are in your rebuttal time, I'm going to give you a little bit more on the back end, but if you want to allow Mr. Anderson to speak.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Robert Anderson for the Commonwealth. I guess I would also intend to discuss primarily the joinder issue, but let me, since what I have to say about double jeopardy is much more succinct, let me just make a couple of points on that, and then I'll move back to the double jeopardy. It's clear under case law, both the U.S. Supreme Court and the Virginia Supreme Court, and this court as well, that the legislative intent is paramount, that, for example, the Blockberger test can be a useful tool, but is not invariably required. If the legislature intended sentences, crimes to be sentenced separately, then that's the end of the inquiry. The defendant, in his reply brief, makes a statement that I find fairly extraordinary. He says, this is at page 8 of his reply brief, Mr. Severance may only be punished once for all the murders that are part of a 3-year period. So, for example, if you had, say, a Ted Bundy serial killer who is arrested in Virginia, and he said, okay, I not only killed this person, but in the last 3 years I've killed 7 others throughout when I was traveling through the state. Apparently, under the defendant's view, you have one sentence. It's very hard to imagine the General Assembly intended that. You also have, I think this came up in argument in the trial court, that a defendant within 3 years could commit 2 first-degree murder convictions, and there'd be no question whatever that he could be punished on each of them. Why is it more favorable to the defendant if he commits 2 capital murders? That just doesn't make sense. What does make sense is what the trial judge said in rejecting the double jeopardy argument. He said something that seems to the Commonwealth to make perfect good sense, which is under 182-31.8, if you kill someone, you are on notice that if in the next 3 years you kill someone else, that is a capital murder, but that the first murder itself is elevated to capital murder as well, so that there is a deterrent effect, hopefully, by the statute. His argument on brief seems to be almost a Blockberger assertion, and yet it's on the record that he conceded that he would lose under the Blockberger test done in the abstract, and that's it. Page 3730 of the appendix.
Let me ask you a question. Something dawned on me as I was going through all of the information and briefs in this matter is that in one instance, the Commonwealth is suggesting that this is a common plan or scheme or single transaction for purposes of joinder. That's how you get to joinder of all of these particular investigations and trials. But on the other hand, when it comes to analyzing this case in the context of Andrews, you're saying it's not really a single transaction. It's something different. How is that consistent?
I agree as to the Commonwealth's argument about Andrews, and I think Judge O'Brien, some of her questions were to the same point, that Andrews any number of times emphasized that it was dealing with murders committed as part of the same transaction or act, which in fact was true. You had 2 murder victims killed in an apartment during a robbery, which is far distinct from the second and third murders in this case, where Mr. Kirby and Mrs. Legato were murdered in separate homes approximately 3 months apart. I disagree on the first part of your question, Judge Austin. I don't quite remember how you couched it, but we certainly have not suggested under the common scheme or common plan components of the 2 Rule 3A provisions that what happened here was part of a common act or transaction. We've conceded that the Dunning case, which of course is a number of years before the first two, is not part of the same act or transaction. The fact that we're arguing that the common scheme and common plan provisions in the two rules were satisfied is by no means inconsistent with the argument that Andrews dealt with something occurring in the same act or transaction. I don't think our argument is in any way inconsistent. On the joinder, of course, it's, and I think if you look at the cases, it's pretty plain that on appeal it's reviewable as an abuse of discretion. And counsel talks, I think, from one case about limited abuse of limited discretion. I think if you look at the cases in their entirety, I don't think there is any such limitation. This is an abuse of discretion standard, unless any and all reasonable jurist could conclude that severance was required. The defendant loses on appeal.
You don't think that this is a BAU's question of law and fact? I think it's a straight factual determination.
No, I think there's clearly factual and legal elements going into the ultimate ruling, but the ruling itself, when all is said and done, the ruling is reviewable as an abuse of discretion.
So you're suggesting that maybe it's a type of abuse of discretion that you use in the context of an illegal search or something like that, the historical facts of what they are, but you still have to superimpose some sort of constitutional legal analysis.
Well, I'm not sure. The answer may be that that is correct, but I'm not entirely sure that's right. I think in this context, I think the trial court looks at anything and everything that's relevant, whether it's factually or legally relevant, and it ultimately concludes severance is necessary here or it's not. Now, I will certainly agree that, for example, on the common scheme, and the lower court found that under the common scheme and common plan test, which the Supreme Court of Virginia has made clear, are distinct, but by no means mutually exclusive, and certainly there can often be a significant overlap. But in the common scheme, that goes to whether or not the crimes share features that are idiosyncratic in nature. Presumably that there is a pretty heavy factual element to that assessment. So to that extent, I would certainly say that the ultimate ruling has a fact-based element to it. But again, and I don't know how much of this is semantical, I think ultimately it's reviewable as an abuse of discretion. The appellant has the opportunity to point to these facts or those legal considerations that would make it an abuse of discretion. But
I understand your point, and there's a circumstance in Andrews that maybe is not entirely clear from the record, but in the Andrews case, they had the three offenses that occurred in the same home, where two of the young men were killed, one of the young men was shot in the head. But in Andrews, there was another murder case that was hooked into that.
Several weeks earlier.
Yeah, that had nothing to do with it. And I know because I actually was a judge who tried the Andrews case, so I have a little background there.
It was very well tried, by the way.
I wasn't reversed on that point. But anyway, there was a hook in Andrews that sort of set it apart from your traditional case because there was that other murder charge that was 3 weeks old.
Right. And at first, it was a simple prosecution under 182-318. Because you had these two murders at this time, you had this separate, distinct murder, I think a week or two earlier. So at that point, there's no question that if you prove it, that's a violation of 182-318. The kicker was the defendant in that separate case was acquitted. That's where the issue, the defendant would have had no reasonable double jeopardy or double jeopardy argument, but for that one circumstance in the case. But I still submit that Andrews repeatedly talked about the fact that you had these murders occurring in one act or transaction, something that plainly did not happen here. And counsel's assertion that a 3-year period under 31.8 is tantamount to the same act or transaction under 31.7, I find highly unpersuasive, and I, more to the point, I find it very difficult to conclude that the General Assembly so viewed it. I guess I should get back a little bit to the joinder issue. I know counsel said in his reply brief, talking about the writings, and this goes to the both to the idiosyncratic nature of the killings under the common scheme and also the objective under the common plan. He asserted in his reply brief that there was no evidence of any of these murderous writings until Mrs. Dunning had been murdered in late 2003. That is simply factually wrong. You have here, among other things, the defendant's, the mother of this poor little boy testified that the custody battles began in 2000. And according to her testimony, this defendant was writing her threatening letters either at home or at work or to her parents until 2009. Frightening letters. Obviously, the trier of fact could infer that they dealt with this matter. So that was well before Mrs. Dunning died. Also, there's evidence that the defendant wrote his son one of these demented letters in 2001. Again, 2 years and however many months before Mrs. Dunning died. You have the defendant's own father testifying, and several, both he and the defendant's mother testified that the defendant was extremely upset, angry about the loss of custody. And by the way, this was not a loss of custody where he was just disappointed with the extent of visitation. It was cut off like that until and unless there was a court order in the future changing it. And the defendant's father said that throughout the 14 years, the defendant's anger over this never abated, never diminished. So I think it is clear. And there was evidence that just as to how nasty the atmosphere was surrounding the 2000 custody battle. So this notion that his anger somehow postdated the Dunning murder is just, I think, is incontestably wrong as a matter of fact. Now, as to the
idiot... Let me ask you the same question I asked your colleague. What, if any, significance to firearms and the ballistic evidence?
Well, I think they, both on the joinder and the sufficiency of the evidence, and clearly there's a significant overlap here between the joinder issue and the sufficiency of the evidence. Another way of saying that is the more idiosyncratic the nature of the killings, the more that strengthens the inference that this defendant was the killer. So there's definitely a significant overlap between the two. I think it is highly significant. And I can't possibly, in the time available here, go through all the particulars of the evidence. I will say this, a couple of things. If I can find this, I hope. This concerns the testimony of the North American Arms General Manager. Maybe it's in just 1 second. I think I can find it. Okay, yes. He said, again, this is a general manager of the North American Arms, which is the company that this defendant repeatedly manifested this obsession about just how great they were, and they were quiet, and they were easily concealed.
You're talking about the testimony that you had filed at 1639-1668.
Well, in particular, 1653, he says that his company was the only, as far as he was aware, his company was the only manufacturer of a five-shot mini revolver with 8 lands and grooves and the right twist. You have also the testimony of 2 state forensic experts, ballistics experts, Mr. Mason and Mr., I think, Hansen, plus Ms. Davis, who, as I understand it, was originally came into the case as a defense witness. And there's a stipulation that literally thousands of forensic examinations were done by the two experts, and they had never seen, except in these three cases, the specific ammunition, revolver, etc. Now, the defendant says, well, there's all this evidence of many, many bullets being produced. This is patently a trial court argument. The trier of fact, and the only thing we're concerned with is what could it reasonably have concluded? If it's reasonable, if it's a reasonable inference, that's it on appeal. The trier of fact could have said, well, you have almost 10,000 of these firearm examinations. It never shows up in any of these three. They could say it speaks for itself. You also have evidence that from the medical examiners that they rarely saw this kind of .22 caliber revolver in the autopsies they conducted. You had evidence that this particular weapon was designed to be concealed, and it was more of a defensive weapon, and it was used with small game. It's interesting, and it was under the speed of sound. It's interesting that in the Lodato case, when Ms. Franco ran frantically to the neighbor behind her, Mr. Roberts, he said he had not heard any shots that morning. He hadn't heard anything until she came over screaming, you know, call 911. That suggests this defendant knew what he was doing. It minimized the prospect of someone else hearing the shot.
Sanderson, your time's expired. I'll give you about a minute to sum up.
Okay. Again, I think there was a heavy overlap here between the joinder issue and the sufficiency of the evidence. If the court upholds the joinder ruling, which in part was premised on the idiosyncratic nature of these three murders, all of which occurred in such a way as to suggest executions at a front door in two homes or three homes near each other, fluent neighborhood, no evidence contrary to what the defendant says on brief, no evidence of a break-in gone bad. There was no evidence of break-in at all. No robbery, no sign of disarray within the houses. It smacks of an execution. It, to put it mildly, these are very, very unusual crimes, particularly low crime neighborhood. It's simply not remotely comparable to, for example, to a robbery gone bad of a convenience store where someone is shot or even killed. Unfortunately, that is not uncommon. Each of these by itself was shocking and shockingly uncommon. Three of them were exponentially more so. So I'd ask the court to uphold the joinder ruling as an appropriate exercise of discretion, and for much the same reasons, uphold the sufficiency of the evidence, and to reject the double jeopardy argument, which simply makes no sense in terms of trying to ascertain what the legislature's intent would have been. Thank you.
I'm going to give you about 3 minutes. Sir.
All right, thank you, Your Honor. I'm not sure I may even need that much. I just wanted to start out just the first point Mr. Anderson raised, citing our brief about our position on how 31-8 would be applied in the context of a serial killer. This is a case that, of course, involved just two murders within a three-year period. So to the extent that that sentence in the brief may imply that somehow a serial killer might only be subjected to one capital murder charge, we cite Buchanan. And that case, I think, makes clear, although it's talking about, again, 31-7, but it breaks out how if there are more than one transaction, you can get more than one capital murder charge. And a serial killer would be subjected to any number of three-year periods. So I think, and I suppose that would be a case of first impression for the court, but I wouldn't be surprised if the finding of the court were that, yes, there's multiple murders throughout multiple three-year periods will lead to multiple capital convictions. As to Mr. Anderson's concerns about our claim that the writings predate the Dunning murder, that was a reference to the notes that were found in searches. I mean, we don't dispute the fact that he wrote his son or that he was playing the game mental disorder in 2002. I mean, there is certainly evidence beginning, I guess, as far back as the late 1990s that he was very angry, very mentally ill, very delusional. We don't deny any of that. Our point is simply that there is nothing in that evidence that explicitly ties Mr. Severance to these murders. And that's true for much of the evidence, not just the writings. The writings are general. They don't say anything about specifically the Dunning, the Kirby, or the Lodato cases. Likewise, the guns, although there's much known about these bullets, there's nothing that conclusively links the murder weapon to Mr. Severance. We know he possessed 22s, but we don't know that he possessed them at the time of the murder. We don't know what the murder weapons are. And in fact, the forensic evidence is that it was probably three different guns, where a different gun was used in each case. And nothing places those guns in Mr. Severance's possession specifically at the time of the murder. So when you look at this evidence in its totality, our position is that while, of course, it may well be suspicious, it may be make one believe that there's a probability that Mr. Severance was the perpetrator of these crimes, it simply is not sufficient to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. So we would ask the court to find that the evidence was insufficient and that the motion to strike should have been granted and these convictions should be reversed. In the alternative, we would ask that because the Dunning case was improperly joined with the other cases, all of the convictions are tainted because you essentially have evidence admitted in each case that would not have been admitted if they were properly severed. I don't believe the Commonwealth's argument about harmless error, I don't think harmless error analysis can be applied to that argument, because if the court concludes that they were improperly joined, then the question of could this evidence come in as other crimes evidence to prove identity, well, the case law talks about how the joinder analysis for common scheme or plan and the other crimes evidence to prove identity are almost identical. So if they're improperly joined, then that evidence would have to conclude couldn't come in as other crimes evidence to prove identity, so that the harmless error analysis wouldn't apply.
Thank you.
Thank you.